This is the Let's Talk Wheels Radio Network. Here's Jeremy Bierenbaum and Mike Herzen.
Welcome, everybody, to Let's Talk Wheels. I'm your host, Mike Herzen, along with Jeremy Bierenbaum. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am awesome. How are things on the left coast?
They're amazing. I just went over to the Peterson Museum. They got a big hot rod fever going on right now, and it's exhibit going on. It's definitely worth a checkout.
We'll talk about that. All right, folks, every week we're going to give you automotive news, interviews, car reviews, and classic car information from our friends at classic.com. And as I always say, they don't know how to spell because it's CLASIQ.com. So get ready for a fun, fast-paced hour. You can also catch this show as a podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Audio Boom, SportsMapRadio.com, or Classic.com. But, you know, it's easier if you just subscribe, so that way you don't miss a thing. All right, Jeremy, today we're going to talk to Ted Ryan. Remember him? He was on just recently, the Ford Company Historian.
Yeah, he's got the coolest job.
They are doing something that's going to make the classic people so excited. And we're not going to tell about it, who it is, what they're doing, but he promised he was going to do this. And guys, if you own a Ford or a Lincoln or a Mercury, you're going to love what they're doing with the Ford Historian people. It's just going to be so cool. So if you've got a classic like that, it's going to be neat. Actually, not even a classic, even if it's something that's only 10 or 12 years old, you're going to find what they're doing is going to be fine. And guess what? It's free. That's the best part. So check that out. All right. That'll be fun. That'll be coming up in the fourth segment of the show. We're also going to do a car review, and I'm going to talk about, yes, I was in a little tiny Nissan Kicks, and it is kind of a kick to drive. All right. And that's fun. We got a lot of classic car news, and we're going to talk a little bit about some about Phantom engine codes, about how those are. People keep trying to fix it, do a code reader and turn off their check engine light. And I'm going to tell you why you're not doing it right. I'm going to help maybe give you a pointer or two, and that's going to be a little fun. And Jeremy's going to share his knowledge about classic cars. So just hang on. We got a lot more to come with our news and notes segment coming up next. This is Mike Herzing along with Jeremy Bierenbaum with Let's Talk Wheels right here on the Let's Talk Wheels Radio Network. So hang on. We'll be right back just after the break.
You're listening to the Let's Talk Wheels Radio Network. Here's Jeremy Bierenbaum and Mike Herzing.
Welcome back to Let's Talk Wheels. I'm your guy, Mike Herzing, along with the classic car guru himself, Jeremy Bierenbaum. All right, Mr. B, you ready to go?
Let's do this. What's going on this week?
All right, this is our news and notes segment, folks. We catch you up on the happenings in the auto industry. And this week, let's just start off with this digital license plate thing. I just got to get past this. There is a thing that the company came out with, and two states are doing this. Michigan just became the third state, so we're on in Michigan, so you guys can listen to this. And about 10 states are considering it. And to me, it's about the dumbest thing I've ever seen, all right?
I've been seeing these around for a little bit. They've been legal in California, so every once in a while you'll see
I rest my case. Like, I rest my case. That? California has them. And I think they're dumb. I rest my case right here. I mean, no, well, I'm not just kidding.
Let's talk about it. They're digital license plates for the back of your car. It looks like a real license plate, but it has some extra, you know, capabilities that you can, you know, it's got GPS and telematics, and it tells you where your vehicle is, how far it's gone. You can flash menus, or not menus, but notes on the bottom of the plate. They can also send amber alerts from the bottom of the plate. Yeah, so there's some options there for you, but it's quite expensive. I think
I have no problem with the plate, Jeremy. I think it's kind of cool. And you know, you can even, if you have trouble finding your car in the parking lot, okay, then of course, if you're that drunk, you shouldn't be driving anyway, but either way, if you can't find your car in the parking lot, it'll help you find it. If somebody steals it, it'll help that. But Jesus, if you pay it off early, for 4 years, just the plate is $861.60. That's for the battery operated version, that you have to replace the battery every 5 years. If you have it the wired in version, which would be the smartest thing, that's $150 installation. Then if you pay it up front, it's $1,101.60. Are you kidding me?
And this is for the license plate that your DMV issues to you for free. You know, in California, you can pay a little bit extra and you can get, you know, a personalized one or those really cool black right. plates with the yellow numbers. Right. And right. you're talking about maybe like $60 a month extra for that.
A month this is, or period?
Excuse me, a pay period.
Yeah. In other words, $60 a year.
Yeah.
Okay. If this was $100 or $200 a year, I'd say, oh, you know, you could put the university of whatever on the bottom, you know, or, you know, don't follow me, I'm lost too, or something at the bottom, kind of cute. But you need to put, I'm an idiot for spending $1,100 for this license plate. Extra. Yeah. $1,100 extra. Are you kidding me?
I mean, there's some cool features to it. You know, you can pay your registration right there. It updates that you don't have to go out and put on the sticker. But is that hard for you that you're willing to kick up $1,100 because you don't want to put your sticker on your car? I don't know if that's worth it.
I don't know. That's crazy. I mean, crazy. But either way, another thing we're talking about, you know, we've always talked about EVs, you know, electric vehicles, and how hard it is to find chargers, you know, in the city of Houston. Or for example, or Dallas or Austin or San Antonio. Yeah, it's great. No problem. Now, if you live in an apartment, you don't have a 240 volts, or you don't have something available for you, that's a little bit tougher. But you can go pay somewhere, pay $10 and get it charged or whatever, and go 180 miles or so on your charge or whatever you want. But if you're traveling, you got to depend on these chargers. And your state, they just did, Berkeley, UC Berkeley, just did a study that says about almost 25% of them are broken. And after talking to EV people, that's about right. Sounds about right. About a quarter of them are broken.
This seems to be like the worst issue that EV people encounter. Right. Most people end up charging at home and they don't have that issue. But I would say for the population that's out there charging their cars in the public, they've had to have run into a problem where they could either not get their credit card working in the machine or not get the actual machine working.
Right.
And it's really frustrating because sometimes it's not like a gas station where you're just like, oh, I'll flip to the other corner. It might be a few cents more or whatever. You can't do that in these electric charging areas because they're few and far between in some places.
You know, you're exactly right. And there was, an event where Nissan Leaf was trying to get to San Antonio. It's about 180 miles from Houston on I-10. And they tried to make it and all the charges, they went to two different chargers and they were broken. You know, I mean, the whole bank was out. And it wasn't anything else. So they basically had to come back to Houston, get a full charge, and then take off again. And they had to come back 50 miles to go back and get the charge and then go. And they had to use a wrecker part of the way. And so, come on. So it can be a nightmare. And doing like from here to my lake house, which is 144 miles, and I go through two towns with about 30,000 or 35 or 40,000 a piece. Each one of them had two chargers, and each one of them was broken. Both chargers were broken, so I couldn't charge. Now, if a dealership was open, I might could go into the dealership and use their chargers, but they weren't. But these guys weren't open after 6 o'clock, and then so I went to another city, and then I could have gone another 30 miles, but I only had 20 miles of range left, so I went to my lake house and plugged it in with the slow charger. But
yeah, there's a lot of concessions that seem to be have to made sometimes when people are at these spots where it's kind of tricky. And the other thing that happens is you pull up to a working charger, but there's a car parked there.
Right.
Maybe sometimes they're charging, but they could be charging up to 40 minutes. But sometimes their car's not even charging anymore and they're still parked in the spot. And now you can't utilize the spot. And it's just kind of a waste for everyone. I've heard that issue before, especially when you go to maybe some of these mountain towns or ski resorts.
Right.
You're trying to get your car charged. They might have three or four electric chargers and that's it.
Right. They may have three or four. There's some of these office buildings where people will charge downstairs and then they go up to work. And then their car is charged in, let's say, 3 or 4 hours, but they don't come down and get their car and move it. Okay.
Right.
They just wait till the end of the day, or maybe they come by at lunch. But the point is, it's kind of like the guy that you pull into the pump and you're waiting for somebody to get fuel, and they get fuel and then they go in to go to the bathroom and leave their car parked there. And you're like,
then they're getting chips and a Slurpee. And 20 minutes later, that car is still sitting there. And you're like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's why they have, you know, it's funny. One of our big things we have in Texas is Bucky's, you know, the big beaver. And one of them has 112 pumps. Now, they have electric charging stations, too. They're putting those in. And they'll have 15 of them or 20. But but then again, it's easy to have 20, you know, EVs there. I mean, they take a while to charge. Don't forget, on an EV, let's say your EV has 220 miles of range. Don't forget, you can only, when you go and do a fast charge, you can only get 80%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it slows down dramatically because the battery doesn't, don't want the battery to overheat. So you can only get 80%. So that, then you're only going to get maybe 180, 190 miles. So think about that.
Well, and then you also talk about like the Tesla supercharging network. They know ahead of time when people are coming in because they have entered it into their car that that's their next destination. And so they're consistently trying to keep people moving. They only allow you to go up to 80%. And after you get to 80%, they charge you idle time. If you're sitting in that charger and there's someone else waiting for that spot, they charge you to sit there.
That's a great idea.
That's actually kind of a great idea to go, oh, hey, I'm in my office working, but I better go move my car. It's like a reverse meter, right?
Yeah. But, you know, the cool thing about Tesla's got it made. Yeah. They have different, they have a different connector for now, at least. The government wants everybody to have the same. But the point is, they have the best network. They have the, they take care of their customers. You know, what's funny is they built the network as they were selling the cars. It isn't like, let's get everybody to buy EVs and make the gas real high and then, oh, let's start putting them in.
Right.
You know, we kind of like the we put the horse before the cart before the horse, you know, and all of a sudden it doesn't work that way. And I know in about 2 or 3 years, it'll catch up dramatically. And right now, that's why, you know, you and I always talk all the time with, you know, the best thing is a hybrid. But either way, let's talk about NASCAR. Daniel Suarez won the Sonoma Sears Point race. You know, it was a road course. The kid's great. He's super nice, but he's Mexican. And I think it's great. It's first one ever win. And I think it's awesome. You know, he did a great job. He did a road course. He won fair and square. And NASCAR is excited about it. Everybody was so excited. And he had a big pinata as a giant taco and broke it open. And he has so much fun. Great kid. And it's really nice. He's had COVID. He's had all these races he's had to miss. He had a really bad crash at the Coca-Cola 600 a couple of weeks ago. But, and actually,
I think anything with these sports that just keeps making it more inclusive and bringing more people into it is always exciting, right?
NASCAR's done a great job after COVID. After it was Chris Buescher that had the wreck, who was second. Good thing to him. And then Joseph Newgarden on IndyCar, he won. They had a special deal that if you win three races, one in each, you know, genre, one road course, one oval, and one street course, you get $1 million bonus. Well, he won it. Okay. And so he split it with a charity. So of the $1 million, $500,000 went to his team and all the guys on his team and everything like that. And the other half of it went to the Nashville chapter of Wags and Walks to build a new dog adoption center. And I think he also did. They also had. Let's see who else. I think they split it with somebody else. There's another charity, but it was so neat. No, I guess it was Wags and Walks. And that is so cool. That's one of those aw kind of things, you know. It's just was great. And I think it's good for him. Don't you think so?
Yeah, definitely. So he won the oval course at Texas, the street course at Long Beach, and then headed to Road America. He was searching for the road course, which he won as well.
It was awesome. So congratulations to them. All right, folks, we got a car review segment coming up. We're going to talk about the Nissan Kicks. And you're listening to Let's Talk Wheels with Mike Herzing and Jeremy Berenbaum. We'll be right here on the Let's Talk Wheels radio network. I'll be right back right after this quick break.
You're listening to the Let's Talk Wheels radio network. Here's Jeremy Berenbaum and Mike Herzing.
Welcome back to Let's Talk Wheels. I'm Mike Herzing along with Jeremy Berenbaum. All right, folks, this is our car review segment, and I want to talk about the 2022 Nissan Kicks. Now, this is a compact CUV. It's little. It seats four, maybe five if you've got a small person in there. It's, you know, base price on this one is the middle grade. It's $22,240. I mean, this is a entry-level CUV, great for kids, great for college kids, young families, fun. You know, it's a good-looking little car, okay? It was redesigned last year in a nice interior, okay? It's got a lot of stuff going for it, but go for it. It is small, okay? Lots of tech, driver assistance tech, you know, it's priced real well. Fuel economy. Okay, folks, I drove it. It's rated 36 on the highway, 31 in the city, 33 is average. I drove it like I stole it, okay? And I think I got 32 average.
I don't think you drove it hard enough.
Oh, you have no idea. I was wide open everywhere I went practically because it doesn't have a whole lot of power. This is the smallest SUV that they have, and it's in below the Rogue Sport. So it's little, okay? It's one of their most affordable. I mean, you can find these things in the S trim in the $21,000 range, okay? It's got a lot of stuff, okay? It's they make the S version, the SV, the SR, which is what I had, and they're just it's just nice. They're front wheel drive. They do not have all wheel drive. The interior is pretty Spartan, but it's little. I mean, you guys understand this is little. Some regular people need to sit in the back seat. You got to scoot the seat up, okay? But it's nice to drive. It's fun. It's easy on gas, and it's cheap, okay? It's inexpensive. I wouldn't say cheap because it doesn't look cheap. It looks good. Fold the seats back down. You got lots of room to go in there and things like that. But it'd go against maybe the Buick Encore or something like that. You know, Chevy Trax. That it's got a 1.6 liter. Four-cylinder engine, you know, not a rocket science, 122 horsepower. Okay, less than my motorcycle. And it's got a CVT transmission, constantly variable transmission, which is kind of what you need to do to get good fuel economy. But if you're doing 70 and you want to punch it, it's like you want to get out and pedal. It's not a, it's not, you know, it's not going to keep up with a Lexus IS, you know, 350 or anything. It's just, no. Now, it'll get there eventually, okay? But you may have to use, you know, won't use a stopwatch. You might want to use something, you know, slower. But
this seems like a good car for someone that's just getting their license maybe, right? Or someone who drives around the city a lot, is not doing a lot of open highway driving. You know, yeah. It's a small little compact car for the city. It almost seems like, you know, the Accord almost, like what kids would be getting in high school.
In the old days, an HRV maybe.
Yeah, CUVs and that sort of thing, so we get them lifted off the ground a little bit more.
17-inch wheels and things like that, but Nissan has done, okay? It's got a round view cameras. So when you go to park it, it's got the views all the way around. You can see you're in the parking lot, right? It's got all of the, when I see that, it's got their safety intelligent round view monitor, dual stage supplemental airbags and things like that. Let's see. It's got so many airbags. I'm looking at anti-lock brake system with brake assist, traction control, vehicle dynamic control, electronic brake force distribution, tire pressure monitoring system, automatic emergency braking with pedestrian. Somebody walks out in front of you, it hits the brakes for you. If somebody's stopping in front of you and it sees that you're not going to hit the brakes, it'll hit the brakes for you. Okay. It does so many things. It's got all of the Nissan's goodies stuff. Okay. Intelligent driver awareness, intelligent cruise control. How about that one? You know, dynamic cruise control. That is so handy. It's got, all this, you know, it's just got Apple CarPlay, Android Auto. See what this suite of safety stuff is called. Nissan calls it. Everybody has their own name. It's Safety Shield 360. Okay. And it comes with all these things. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, when you look at the lane divergence and lane keeping assist and the braking assist and the backup assist, and you're backing up out of the parking lot and you're backing up out of in your Walmart and you're backing up and there's an F-150 next to you and you can't see anything and you go to back up and you're hoping nobody's coming, Well, if there is somebody, it'll warn you and tell you and stop you, you know.
Most drivers nowadays argue, oh, I don't need that. But the one time you use it in the lifespan of the car, it saves you, whether it's from an accident or hitting a person or looking silly, you know, in a parking lot. It's just better for you.
Well, be honest with you, this is kind of an entry-level vehicle, okay? Or you could say for an older person, an exit-level vehicle. It's great for towing behind a motorhome or something like that. But honest to God, it's the entry-level and the exit-level for the people that need this kind of safety stuff more than anybody.
Yeah.
Okay. Kids don't know how to drive. Okay. And they, they're too distracted. It really is.
And an experience. It's a combination of both.
All right. And, it's not, it had heated seats and things like that. It was really nice. If I was going to change anything on this vehicle besides the transmission, that I really hate CVT transmission, I would give it another maybe 25 horsepower. But it handles good. It's fun to drive on the highway. It's not terribly noisy. It's about right about everybody else. It comes with the bottom trim level comes with 16 inch wheels. The nicer trim levels like I had was 17 inch wheels. But basically, with all some odd items, and it's got a nice Bose audio system. It sounded great. All this stuff.
It actually looks like there's an option. You can get a Bose speaker in the headrest of the seat, like the old school Mazda Miatas.
Right. And it has all this stuff. I mean, the whole thing was less than $25,000. I mean, and that sticker. And it'll be a time coming back that you can get it below sticker. But it's a fun vehicle. It's safe. And it's got side impact, five-star ratings. It's got four-star rollovers, frontal crashes, 4 stars. Overall vehicle is four stars. I mean, fuck, if I'm going to buy my kid a car, it's all right. Here's your car from high school through college, and you're done. Okay. And I'm done. I saved up for it. Here's your car. This would be a good one. It really would.
Yeah, definitely. I'd be appreciative as a kid to get one of these.
But I mean, even as you're growing up and you have your own kids and things like that, or you got a wife or this, or the girl's got a husband, or whatever, significant other. It's work.
It's not at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I took it on the highway. It's really okay. Like I said, I drove it at 75 and 80 miles an hour everywhere I went or more to keep up with traffic. And I've got 31, 32 miles a gallon. Come on. You can't beat that. And if you slow down
nowadays
on a regular freeway and you're doing 65 or 70, it gets 35, 36 easily. I think I got 37 at one point. So you can't beat it. All right, folks, check out the 2022 Nissan Kicks. If you want a fun little car that's good on gas and it doesn't break your pocketbook, that would be the one. All right. We only got about a minute left, but folks, we're going to continue this conversation about codes. Everybody has been getting all these emails from folks, and Mike at Let's Talk Wheels or Jeremy at classic.com, CLASIQ.com. And we'll be glad to help you with stuff, but people keep problem with check engine lights going on. And when the check engine light comes on, it tells you the system that it's giving the weird signals. It doesn't tell you that component is what it is. Okay. An oxygen sensor code could be the oxygen sensor bad. Could be. Happens some of the times, but it could be something like a thermostat making the engine run too cold and it's running too rich, which means that the oxygen sensor is going to come on, or the engine is running too lean because of an air leak and the oxygen sensor light comes on. So it doesn't mean the oxygen sensor is bad. It means it's doing its job. It gives you a direction to look. Then you get your scan tool and look at all the data and say, let me look at this first. And there you go. So then if you've got an electrical problem, it's going to cause more phantom codes. And we'll talk about phantom codes at some point. So we ran out of time, and I wish I could talk to you guys about it, but we don't have the time right now. But I promise you, by next week, I'll put some time aside to go over this. All right, folks. Mike Herzing, Jeremy Berenbaum. We got Ted Ryan coming up next from the Ford historian guy. So it's going to be great. And this is going to be an announcement that classic car lovers are going to love. This is Mike Herzing, Jeremy Berenbaum, Let's Talk Wheels Radio Network. Be right back right after this quick break.
You're listening to the Let's Talk Wheels Radio Network. Here's Jeremy Berenbaum and Mike Herzing.
Okay, folks, welcome back to Let's Talk Wheels. I'm your host, Mike Herzing, along with the awesome Jeremy Barenbaum from Classic.com. As we talked about and promised, this week we've got Ted Ryan. He's the Ford company historian and runs a whole team of people that really get a chance to play with Ford's rich history. Ted, welcome back, buddy.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about the Ford Heritage Vault. This has been a two-year labor of love.
Well, talk to us about that. You've got something you guys been working on. And, you know, like you just said before we got on the air, this is, phase one of five. So it we're is. Just so, getting started.
Yeah, we launched the Ford Heritage Vault. Let me say it clearly. So FordHeritageVault.com. And in it, we have over 5,000 digitized assets from the Ford archives. We have a curated collection of 2,500 plus photos. And we have every Ford, Lincoln, and Edsel automobile. Notice no Mercury's in there yet, but we will get them. and we tried to do every model. So if you are looking at a 56 Lincoln, you can get a Capri, a Cosmopolitan, and a Continental. And we should have a couple of beauty shots of each in there. Then my favorite part of the collection is there's more than 3,500 brochures. Pretty much every brochure in our collection from the Model T until the 2018 F-Series. It's been digitized. They're downloadable. They're machine readable so that you can scan within the document itself. So if you, I gave a presentation to a T-Bird club yesterday, and they're so excited because the entire universe of T-Bird brochures are now available online for them to download. They don't have to go scrounging the internet trying to find this stuff. So we're excited to make this available to the public, and I'd be real curious with your listeners to see how they're going to activate it.
This is super cool. And coming from someone who's had to like scan a lot of documents and do a lot of this process, this is really hard, intensive stuff. So it's really cool to see that your team has like gone out there and gone the extra effort to do this, right? Secondly, I'm glad you said that you guys are adding Mercury. That was the second search I did this morning when I got the link sent over. But the first one was for a Ford 56 Ford F-100. That was the first car I ever owned. So I just wanted to see what kind of documents you guys had. And there were two really cool brochures. I downloaded them. One of them is 12 pages color. The quality is amazing. It's not like you zoom in and it gets a little pixelated or anything like that. These are like super crisp, clear scans. So that's really awesome for any fan, anyone looking to add a little bit to their collection, right?
Jeremy, that is music to my ears. Keep in mind, you're talking to an archivist, and I run a group of archivists, and this is what we do for a living. We know how to capture information and make it available, and we've been doing it for years, decades, inside of Ford Motor Company. This is the first time we're doing it for the public. And we had a kickoff meeting 2 years ago where I said, imagine a school kid doing a report on the Mustang. Where can they find stuff? Or a media member who's looking for a last second photo of a Ford Taurus. You know, we wanted everybody to be able to have access to our raw material the same way that we do, and we make it available internally.
I just think about someone trying to restore a car and just the photos and the images that you have, and when someone's trying to figure something out, because there are like breakaway images and engine breakdowns. There's a picture of the frame on this F-100. Like, those are really valuable pieces of information.
And color spectrum. So you can look at a brochure. I did the same thing. My first car was a 77 Mercury Capri. So that brochure is in there. But I downloaded it and I was like, oh yeah, that's the exact name of the color of my car. And it's just so cool to be able to do that. But this is only step one. Coming next is Mercury. Coming shortly after that will be concept vehicles between 1955 and 1975. Cars that never were. And then we're going to do the Ford factories, the World War II, so you can get the Rouge, Willow Run, all of those. And then we're going to do Ford of England. We just finished scanning 60,000 Ford of England cars. So if you want your pictures of your console or your Anglia or all the different British greats, those will be going in hopefully by the end of the year.
Ted, this is, wow, it's a lot of work. This guy is tickled. This is like a little kid, and we're the same way. Because, you know, I had my first vehicle was a 63 Econoline, you know, and it had 250,000 miles on it when I got it. And then my second one was a 71 Econoline that I rode, drove all across the country when I was racing motorcycles. And so to realize things like what color was the block, you know, because I know Ford, some of them were blue, and some of them were black, but most of them were blue. And what color did they paint the heads, and about the intake and all this and all these different things. And also, if I've got one to sell, what a neat to have all this documentation to go with it. And and you're, but I never really thought about what Jeremy just said. I mean, I could go back and say, look at the different trim levels and say, which one is mine? And all these different things, because the VIN number back then didn't really tell you all the trim levels and all of the information that, that your 17 digit, your 17 character VIN does now. So this is a real treasure trove. And folks, it's free. FordHeritageVault.com. That's the coolest thing. And as you're digging through archives, I know you've got buildings you don't know, you know, you don't even have, you don't even know you have. As you run across more things and stuff like that, maybe misplaced or whatever, you're going to scan those in too to fill in the gaps, right?
That's it. We have 2.5 million negatives in our collection, and we've only scanned about 150,000 of them. So we have so much more still to do. And, you know, it's job security. I could go for years and never finish. But putting it online was sort of the last step. This was available internally, like I said, a couple, you know, but Joe Q Public couldn't get it. They had to go to they had to go to other people. They had to try to find it on the web. And we just wanted to make it available. One other thing real quick, just to tout the horn of my staff, is that Ford is committed to being a totally accessible web company. So that if you're vision impaired or hearing impaired, those materials need to be, the website itself is, but we also did the extra mile on the brochures. So the Mustang, F-Series, Econoline, and Bronco have all gone through an added layer of accessibility. And then we have a button on every single brochure description page saying, I need this made accessible. So if someone is hearing or vision impaired, they can request it and we'll do it. You know, we wanted everybody to be able to enjoy the site that we worked so hard to create.
That is so cool.
That is so cool, because, you know, cars are so inclusive in just the amount of people that are able to interact with them, and they, everyone has their own personal feeling to it. Your guys' team must have gone crazy going through all these slides and organizing and putting them together. Did you come out of this and see one particular brochure or car that stood out to you and was like, I didn't remember that quite like the way it was?
It's funny, he brought up Econoline. Part of the work I did was working on the Econoline once, and it's like, oh my gosh, I remember the three on the tree that my dad had. I think he had a 67, and it just brings back so many memories of what cars used to be. And I always say cars have an emotional place in our lives. We give nicknames to a few things: our kids, our pets, and our cars, and maybe a musical instrument, but that's it. And it's because we have this emotional bond, and our goal was to make our material available to feed that bond or to help a kid doing a paper in high school. So either way, you can enter this from any way you want.
You know, you're exactly right. And you mentioned something, people name their cars. You know, my first van was named Norman. The second one was Tyrone, you know, and because it was wild. But, you know, it's funny how I did,
wild, or the driver was wild.
There you go. I did surveys and stuff for years. And so as a journalist growing up, or just as a mechanic and a shop owner and things, and it's real funny. As a general rule, people that own domestics, the traditional domestic, now it's all jumbled up. But back in the old days, the big three, everybody named their cars. It was such an emotional attachment. But then when the imports came in, you know, the Hondas and the Toyotas and the Nissans or the Datsuns back then, it wasn't quite so much. A few people did, but not everybody. And then eventually now it's kind of changed. But for years, I mean, people were the Ford. My dad was a Ford guy. My dad was a Chevy guy. My dad was a Dodge guy. And there was just, now we all had friendly disagreements, you know, but it was all cool. You know what I mean? But it's so neat when you said you name things, and it's the emotional attachment to these vehicles is nuts. And that's what a lot of us try to get back when we buy a classic car. And here you have helped us come back to, this is my first car. I can go back and look at my first, you know, my Econoline, or I can look, because they were all used when I got them. My you know, 71 had 82 Bronco. You know, I used to work at a Ford dealer for years. So I had all these things. And I watched the Starsky and Hutch, you know, Torino come out, the Pinto cruising wagon. I watched the guys do make ready on them. I watched the guys do make ready on the, what was it? The Crown Victoria, I guess, that would start when it was in reverse, and it would back up, and one almost ran over me one time. I jumped out of the way. But, you know, all this kind of stuff happens, and the dealers fixed them before they even made it to the public. But still, it was just so neat. And but the cars were just so interesting. They had their faults, but so did we. Yeah. So it all worked that way. Right, Jeremy?
Definitely. One thing I'm noticing is, you know, along with the brochures and stuff, there are some pretty cool high quality photos that you could possibly like print and put up in your garage or something like that. I know that's always something cool that you see people do, and they're right here. They're really nice. And you got them in all these cool different specs. I'm looking at a 302 Boss car that's yellow with red interior right now.
Right. Everything is free. Everything is downloadable. There is a notice on the front page that says that you can't commercially use it. So don't print it and put it in your garage, but don't print it and put it online and start selling them.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely.
They're digitally watermarked. We would know eventually. But we wanted people to be able to do that. If you are a Mustang fanatic, we'll print the photos and you know, use them to decorate or turn them into a wallpaper for your computer. But everything free, everything downloadable, everything scanned at a minimum of 300 DPI, some of up to 600 DPI, which is why those brochures, all the listeners out there, they may take a minute to download because they're big files. One of the brochures this morning was 167 megabytes, but it was 12 pages of Splendor, and you could blow it up full size. It's amazing.
That's exactly it. I'm zooming in and zooming in and zooming in, and you can get to all the little detailed photos and what the descriptions are underneath and stuff. It's talking about the wood.
That's because these are the same files that I give to the marketing team. They've got to be high res. They've got to be good. So you're essentially, you and your listeners are getting the same access to the same documents that the Ford marketing people have been able to get for years. Now we're just making it for everybody.
That's awesome.
All right, folks, don't forget FordHeritageVault.com. Oh my gosh, this is so cool. I'm looking at some of these pictures and the Mustangs and you know, all the way from the 40s and the Econoline trucks. I can see that all the stuff that you scanned in here. Ted, folks, we're talking to Ted Ryan, the Ford company historian. This guy has the coolest job. I even see motorhomes here, you know.
You do, you know, some of the brochures, you'll see recreational vehicles in some of the brochures. So it's fantastic.
Yep.
Even the language that's used is you know, slightly different than how we speak today and how we describe. So when you get to look at them, it's really interesting.
Oh, Ted, thanks for joining us today. This is so interesting. We'll have to get you back on in a few more weeks and see how the launch has gone and how people have accepted all this and gone crazy and all the thank yous you've gotten. How about that?
hopefully. Knock on wood.
All right, folks, that was Ted Ryan, the Ford company historian. Don't forget, FordHeritageVault.com. All right, this is Mike Herzing, Jeremy Bierman. After this short break, we'll be right back with more Let's Talk Wheels, and it's right here on the Let's Talk Wheels radio network.
You're listening to the Let's Talk Wheels radio network. Here's Jeremy Bierenbaum and Mike Herzing.
Welcome back. Let's Talk Wheels. I'm your host, Mike Herzing, along with Jeremy Bierenbaum. Jeremy, talking to Ted Ryan is always so much fun. And
I know. I'm so jealous. He gets to hang out with all the cool stuff, the cool people, the cool cars. It seems like a dream job.
He has a whole team of people that go through this. But to go through and look at all those brochures for all these years, thousands and thousands of brochures. So now I've got a 73 Mercury, whatever Cougar that I want to sell. I can print out a brochure on it. I can print out all this data and information on it. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I love just reading how the cars were displayed back in the day when they were for sale, the options they had available, what you could get with the car, like all that stuff is, you know, sometimes gets hidden by history. And you don't really realize what else you could have gotten with your car.
No kidding. There's all these options, and it makes you, it's kind of like buying a new car. What you have all these sales brochures, you know. Yeah. Only it better if you could get the window sticker and things like that. But all right, folks, on our podcast, which is coming up, if for those of you that like to get on our podcast, which is you can find on iTunes, Spotify, Audio Boom, SportsMapRadio.com, or of course, Classic.com, Classic.com. That way you're going to hear us talk about this Toyota Supra that went for a crazy amount of money, belonged to an alleged drug dealer, and it sold. It was a 99 Supra, just like in the movies, you know, the Fast and Furious, and went for so much money. I know it had less than 30,000 miles, but oh my gosh. But what got me is how much the auction companies charged. So we're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about some of these vehicles like this and why they're selling for crazy amounts and why some of them aren't. And also, don't forget, folks, you can find us on Facebook, also on Instagram as Let's Talk Wheels SBN. Now, Jeremy is available at jeremy@classic.com, Classic.com. And I'm at Mike at Let's Talk Wheels. So as always, folks, we're running out of time. See how it is. On behalf of Jeremy Berenbaum, our producer Sean Mapes, and myself, I want to thank you for joining us today on the Let's Talk Wheels Radio Network. I'm Mike Herzing. We'll talk to you next week. And for those of you that are hanging on for the podcast, this is going to be a good one. Welcome, ready to the Let's Talk Wheels Classic Car segment. All right, folks, Jeremy Berenbaum, Mike Herzing, Jeremy's from classic.com, Classic.com. And we're going to talk about classics today. And there's something that was kind of nuts. Jeremy, I sent you this article. It was actually on Fox News about a 1998 Toyota Supra, which are pretty cool cars, I have to admit, especially after the Fast and Furious. Sold because it was a drug dealer and the government took all of his cool cars. He had a bunch of old, you know, imports. I call them rice rockets, but that may be offensive. But either way, I'm sorry. I do it in a very honorable idea, but here. But it sold for $308,725. The guy had 29 vehicles in Massachusetts
That's crazy. Sometimes I always wonder when you see this, like, crazy number on these vehicles, like, who bought it? Why did they spend that much? Did they look at the last one that sold? You know, were they even close?
It's a pretty color. It's kind of a silverish, and it's got the little wing on it, but it's totally stocked, guys. This is total stock.
And the reason that someone's paying the big bucks for it, it had 22,000 miles on the odometer. I mean, that's really that's low, but I've seen much lower. I would have assumed, you know, for 300K it would have been somewhere in like the 5,000 to 10,000 mile range.
Yeah, 13 of them.
The funny thing is the high bid was actually $265,000.
Right.
There was a 15% buyer's premium.
Are you
on the
kidding
car.
Me? Are you 15% buyer's premium?
That's
now,
a big chunk of money. Now I'm not sure if that's coming off of one side of the car or that's on both sides.
No, that was the buyer's premium. So that's the buyer pays point. That. Okay. The seller, there may have been a seller premium on it too. I don't know. But it was only one of 24 finished in Quicksilver paint. The high bid was $265,000, but the auction house, like you said, charged 15%. Are you kidding me?
There have been a few other supers, just a few that have sold over the $100,000 mark, including a 97 15th anniversary edition, which went for $195,000. Another one was one of the cars from Fast and Furious. But this is some crazy money.
Right. But here's one. There's 93 Supra with 8,100 miles. It's white. And it got $272,550. That includes the buyer premium. It was $237. $237,000, and then it was $272,550 with the premium. That's nuts. But he had 13. Seven of the other Supers also sold for over $100,000, including a 1997 15th anniversary edition from $195,000. I mean, this guy was just selling pot, okay? And for some reason,
something better.
No, he was in for marijuana, okay? and charged with trafficking, but he was found dead in a building several weeks after skipping his arraignment hearing. The cause of his death is still listed as undetermined. So that sounds cartel-like, but either way, kind of like a movie. But this is nuts, Jeremy. I mean,
it's definitely nuts. And when we talk about it, you know, it's a really interesting car for the period that it came out. You know, it was beating cars at a much, you know, more expensive price tag. Twin turbo. It had 350 horsepower, somewhere around there. The base version had 220, 315 pound feet of torque. It was more horsepower than the Nissan 300ZX. I know it was, you know, faster than some of the Corvettes of its time. Some of the, what are the other cars? I'm trying to think of some of the Porsches. The 928 GT is another one that it was put up against, and even the Acura NSX. And I don't think Toyota has really touched that level of performance in a car since then.
No, all they have is the little F86 or whatever it's called.
Yeah, now they have the new Supra, which is cool, but it doesn't have the same type of performance characteristics that this one had. And I think that's really why you're seeing the big bucks on these cars. Definitely the color and definitely the low mileage as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And it's stock. I mean, it's not like he's got fancy paint job or this or that. It is stock. And so, you know, guys, this is great. But you got to understand, you keep even an import like that. I just call it an import, but just call it an Asian car like that. If you can keep it and it not let it rust, which is they had a tendency to do, they're worth some big bucks. You know, like a 93 Integra would be worth, but it's not looking at, you're not looking at $300,000.
No, but definitely. But you do bring up a good point that it's the stock high horsepower variants that usually end up bringing the most money. When people modify them and change them a lot, they're cool. They end up bringing some bucks within their own realm, but never what an unmodified car would bring.
Oh, I know. Sometimes you'll get a Chevelle, or you'll get this at one of your, you know, auction vehicles, and it has all these modifications on it, but then you'll get a stock, you know, high horsepower numbers matching,
It can only be stock. It can only be original one time, right?
SS, and it's all the numbers right. It's one of the, you know, because when you buy these things, you could buy them in so many different levels. You could buy it with this package, and you know, it's kind of like buying a Monte Carlo, 71 Monte Carlo, and it's got, you know, all the cheapy stuff on it, and the little 350, and that's it. Or you're going to buy it with a 454, and you're going to buy, you know, all this other stuff. There's a difference, and they're worth, and but the value is so much different. And when these people take these things and they'll put a blower on it, they'll put this on it, they'll put that on it. And you look at it and you go, man, that would have been a great car if it was still stock. It'd be worth, yeah, it'd be worth so tough. Much more money, but I don't know the
when
story.
It's your own and you want to personalize it. You don't have the forethought that you're going to keep the car for another 20 years or whatever it may be, you know? So sometimes it's hard to think about that, but like we always say, if you're going to modify, if you're going to change, save those parts so we're able to put it back to stock for the next person down the line.
Don't do anything that's permanent, folks. I mean, that makes such a big difference. But there's a lot of people that will bet, they'll get a Buick and they'll make it look like a Grand Sport, or they'll get an Olds Cutlass, but they'll put all the 442 stuff on it. You know, and they'll make it look like a Hurst Olds or something like that.
Right.
And that's great, but it's not going to raise the value that much, but it's going to raise the value to you, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's for those people that either can't find that Hurst Olds they want, or maybe can't afford it. And so they still want to have it. They like the color scheme. They like the look of the car. And so they go out and then they recreate it, which is totally cool. You can never knock a person for that. We're talking more just like the value of an original car, for a desirable original car is always going to be higher than something that's been modified or messed with.
Of course. And if you've got a Lincoln Town Car and it's the 70s, and you've got one that's a town car and it's great, but then you get one that's a Cartier version or one of these other, you know, designer.
Put a blower on it, put some airbags, hydraulics. It doesn't really matter. Enjoy that thing and run it like you want. But, you know, we're talking about 70 Chevelle SS.
Right.
People are looking for that 396 motor and the 4-speed original transmission and those sort of things.
Right. But like I said, if you found a town car and you see five town cars, but one of them's a Cartier model or one of the designer series, that one's going to be worth definitely a lot more than the other ones. Okay. Yeah. So if you run across something like that and some, maybe an estate sale, or you've got a friend of a friend of a friend and he's selling something that's kind of unique, I tell you what, keep an eye out for that, because that's when you get these bargains. Not only is it this, it's a 68 or 69 or 70, 68 or 79 Camaro, but it's a Copo Camaro, or it's this, or it's that, you know, what is it? Was it Yanko also?
Yanko or Copo. You find one of those, you're doing well.
Yeah. And the Pimmy says, oh, it's a 68 Camaro. Yeah, I'll take it. Here, I'll give you 10 grand for it. Okay. And it's worth 50. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, that's when you do your research and you learn that stuff. It's like saying, I've got a Mustang, got a 68 Mustang, and you look over it and it says Shelby on the side, and you go, let's look at the VIN number here.
Exactly.
This happens to be a Shelby GT500. Okay, well, gee, it's just a Mustang. Okay, yeah, it's just a Mustang. And then you go out and run out and you go to the bank and say, give me all my money.
Yeah. But, you know, going back to that 15%, you know, some of these auction houses can charge that because, where else are you going to find a 1 of 24, 22,000 mile twin turbo Toyota Supra? That was a lot of T's in the alliteration there. But, you know, that's the reason they're able to justify that high percentage, is because the cars that they're bringing in aren't things that you're going to find off the street.
Also, they've got the state of Massachusetts come to them and say, I just want to sell this here. Yeah, handle it. And they do everything, you know, they'll clean it, they wad it, may get it running, they'll do all this other stuff, and they add charge for all that. And then they get to charge whatever they want. If it was an actual seller going, wait a minute, I'm not letting you charge that much, I want that extra money, then they would negotiate it down a little bit, I would think.
And that's some of the similar things that we at Classic are doing. You know, we get a 4.5% commission on our sales, but you know,
you need to go up.
Yeah,
clearly. You need to go up on your prices, clearly.
Clearly, now, after we're seeing and tasting 15%, but you know, we're doing some of the work for the seller, and we're also helping connect the buyer. So, you know, some people are very appreciative of the legwork that ends up happening behind the scenes when they purchase these cars.
Yeah, so folks, when you look at auctions and things like that, don't realize that that's not the price that somebody's going to pay. And also, or for example, that's the price, but then the seller has to pay something. I don't know what the seller's fees on this one. Well, I bet you there's some, because at most of the other auctions, there is a seller's fees also, right?
Correct. That, and when you're comping a car, when you see something that sells at auction, you need to make sure that you're like, oh, I have the exact same one in the garage. And first you have to, one, make sure you do have the exact same one. Your make and model are not just specific enough. It's going to be motor combination with transmission, interior, convertible hardtop. But then the other thing is, if you're trying to compare your car in your garage to one that sold at, say, Barrett Jackson, you have to take into account the 7 or 15% that they put, and they tack that number sometimes onto the price of the car. So you go, oh, wow, I want to sell my car with Barrett Jackson because they're getting 55K for it. But the reality is they got 45K, and then they got their fees and everything on top, and they list that all. So when you're comping, you really need to make sure that you're comparing apples to apples, and you're adding that percentage on the back end, or not adding, or you're taking it off when you're making that comparison.
Yeah, because most everybody has sellers and buyers fees, and then there's all these fees you pay to put it in the auction, and there's so many, you know, not just a percentage. You pay fees anyway, and then if it sells, you pay more fees.
Right.
And so it never stops, folks. So just think about that. All right. That was fun. We're going to talk about more about this next week. All right, folks. That was great, Jeremy. Thank you so much for putting in your 12 cents. All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in this segment of the podcast. We're going to have a bonus car review from our longtime co-host and host of the Bostonian versus the Book podcast, Matt Perrault, coming up right after this. So have a great week once again, folks. And please subscribe to the podcast, and we sure hope you enjoy it.